You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Alla Fairbrook.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a fantastic show for you today. But before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about a couple of sponsors who make the show possible each and every day. Craig Allinson has a brand new book. It's a spinoff of the Expeditionary Force series, Expeditionary Force Mavericks Book 1, Death Trap. The human soldiers stranded on the planet Paradise have been recruited into an alien legion to do the dirty jobs that the high-tech species won't do. Their first mission is to kick the enemy off a backwater planet no one cares about. It's a simple assignment, except everyone has a hidden agenda, and the planet could become a death trap. Craig Allinson's brand new book, Death Trap. Also thanks to Ernie Lindsay with his Sarah series, the psychological thriller series that begins with Sarah, has books 1-3 and a bonus novella, Single Mother, Successful Executive, Target for Revenge. The psychological thriller series box set, Sarah Winthrop's world is thrown headlong into a whirlwind of chaos along with her family, friends, and colleagues by unseen enemies seeking revenge. Those lurking in the shadows clawing for vengeance will go to any lengths. Any lengths. It's likely never occurred to them that they may have just messed with the wrong woman. The Sarah series, books 1-3 and a bonus novella by Ernie Lindsay. Also, John L. Monk with The Jenkins Cycle. From Book 1, Kick, a supernatural thriller. They say suicides are damned for eternity, but if possessing the bodies of violent criminals is hell, then Dan Jenkins will take it. And he does. Every time a portal arrives to whisk him from his ghostly exile. Normally, before the villain returns to kick him out, Dan dishes out a final serving of justice and leaves the world a safer place. It's one of the rules if he wants more rides, and he's happy to oblige. For a part-time dead guy, it's a pretty good gig. And then he meets her. Kick is the first book in a series of supernatural thrillers. If you like Quantum Leap and Every Day, you'll love this gritty and original take on the body-hopping hero story. Vividly written, Kick is a wild ride with a sharp, sarcastic wit and a flawed, yet likable main character. From John L. Monk, The Jenkins Cycle, Book 1, Kick. And from M.D. Massey, Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. The action-packed first novel in M.D. Massey's Them Zombie Apocalypse series. When a surprise nuclear attack forces Aiden from hiding, he finds the world to be a much different place and more deadly. Now he'll traverse a post-apocalyptic landscape populated by violent redneck looters, rogue military factions, and an army of hungry undead. After two combat tours in the Middle East, Aiden Sullivan just wants to be left alone on his family's ranch in the Texas Hill Country. But when the bombs fall and the dead walk, Aiden risks life and limb to rescue his aging parents from the zombie horde. To save them, he'll traverse half the state of Texas while fighting rogue military units, violent redneck looters, and thousands of walking dead. The question is, can he make it there in time? Only one thing's for sure, this ranger will complete the mission or he'll die trying. M.D. Massey's Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. Now on to our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Alla Fair Burke on the show with me today. Alla Fair is a New York Times and internationally best-selling author, more than 18 books, an amazing author in her own right, also co-authors a series with Mary Higgins Clark, and is just doing amazing, amazing things. Her brand new book is called The Better Sister, and this book closes out a trilogy of sorts that we will talk about a little bit later in the show. Welcome to the show, Alla Fair.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you today. I've had the book for, I guess, a couple of weeks now, and it is amazing. It is right up my alley for the types of books that I love, and you grabbed me from page one and didn't let go.
That's the goal. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for writing such an amazing book. Before we get into all of that good stuff that we're going to talk about, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, it goes back when I was really little. My dad is a writer still, James Lee Burke, and I would watch him on his manual typewriter, and I loved the sound of it, and there was something special about it. Like, we knew that when that sound was happening, like, not to be too crazy and let Dad work, and I would sneak in there, and I think before I even knew how to, you know, spell anything, I would just go in there and stick a piece of paper in there and just hit the keys just to get the sound, and then I would write little stories here and there, but that was as a little kid. And then I kind of gave it up for academic stuff and became a lawyer. But it wasn't until I was working at the district attorney's office in Portland, Oregon, where I am now, that I got an idea for a book. And I turned into yet another lawyer who wanted to write a book. But it went back to, you know, those little stories I used to write when I was a little kid. And there were always mysteries, even the ones I wrote when I was little.
I love it. Isn't there something magic about the sound of a typewriter? It's like you just know that something is coming out of that's bigger and better than the real world. It's one of those things. I think it connects across people and generations. There's something, we know something is being made when we hear that sound.
Well, I think it is generational, though, because if you can tell people who learned how to type on a typewriter, especially people like me who learned how to type on a manual typewriter, because, I mean, if you look at I'm looking at my laptop keyboard right now, all of the keys are just obliterated because I hit them so hard. So when I'm really, like, when I'm typing really, like, in a frenzy, when I'm in the zone and I'm on an airplane, I can tell people are looking at me like, does that woman know she doesn't need to hit the keys so hard? But I think younger people, you know, they don't know what it was like to type on a machine that could fight back.
Right, exactly. Oh, man, I remember playing on a manual typewriter that my grandparents had. But when I was in high school, we had actual typing class. Before there were computer classes, and we learned on IBM Selectrics. Mm-hmm. And there was something about putting your fingers on those home row keys and feeling the vibration of the machine it's just tactile. I guess it is generational now that I think about it. But, do you ever break keyboards?
My keys have popped off before.
I love it. Yeah, I have a mechanical keyboard at my desk, just because it's loud and it makes, you know, clacky sounds when I type, and I love it. It's one of those weird writer things. You said that even those early stories that you wrote were mysteries. Can I assume that you were a pretty avid reader when you were young?
Yeah, my mom was a librarian on top of my dad being a writer, English professor.
You were hopeless, weren't you?
There were a lot of books. It was not optional in our family.
What were the kinds of books that captured your imagination? Were they mysteries?
I liked mysteries really early on, and I think it caught my mother by surprise because you know, she was trying to get me to read all the great books that people should read. And I was like, Mom, I want mysteries. So we would go to the public library in Wichita, Kansas, where I grew up. Do you remember those Encyclopedia Brown books?
Oh, my gosh, that was
like
my
child
favorite book.
The boy detective.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, he has Sally, like his little manager, his tough female neighbor who would stick up for him. But I loved those little, because they were mysteries, and then you'd flip to the back to see if you'd solve them. And I think I loved the challenge of it, of whether I could figure it out. And so I got very addicted to those. And then it was on to Nancy Drew. And then it was, I started reading Mary Higgins Clark's books when I was pretty young. And it's so bizarre that I now co-author with her. I've got to pinch myself sometimes. So Like, who would have thought?
Exactly. I remember those Encyclopedia Brown books. I can remember the plot lines of some of them still, you know, 40 years later. It's so funny, those early influences, how they stick with you and still inform, you know, the way you think about writing. It's amazing.
Yeah, I still remember that the classic way he'd catch people write is like, we never said that it was a stolen quarter, because it could have been a two dimes and a nickel, you know.
Exactly.
And then, there was a sword. You remember the one? There was like,
oh yeah,
that it was fraudulent because it was dated BC.
I remember
and like,
one.
Right, they wouldn't have known to call
they
it BC.
And I remember one where someone claimed that he had been on the road and he couldn't have committed this crime, but he had a toddler standing on the hood of the car, and Encyclopedia Brown said, if you just got back from a 400-mile trip, the hood would be too hot for that.
Yeah.
You know, guy foiled again.
So good.
Oh, man. Well, growing up with a dad like James Lee Burke, who has written amazing books all of my life, did he ever share like writing tips with you, or was it just kind of being around someone like that?
No, it's just, I mean, oh my God, how insufferable if he just sat around and like talked about writing.
Okay, here's right.
He's not like that at all, but. Just seeing the dedication to doing it, you know, so many people, I think there's lots, I'm sure there's people listening who, you know, think that they would like to write a book, but it takes a lot of dedication to sit, particularly when it's your first book, because you have no idea whether anyone will ever read it, whether it'll get published, you know, you could be completely wasting your time. How's that for encouragement to aspiring authors? It's a ridiculous thing to try to do. But to see somebody who was so dedicated to it, because when I was growing up, he was out of print. He had three books really early on, like before I was even around, and then he was out of print for about 12 years. So those were the years that kind of my formative years. He was teaching and not publishing, but he, you know, I could still hear that typewriter. And you know, that was when you mailed hard copies to New York, and they'd come back, you know, rejected. That just seemed normal to me. So when I did get an idea for a book, it seemed very natural to me that, yeah, you know, I'll try to write it down and see what happens, you know, without, and to this day, I still assume every book's going to be my last book, because you just never know when readers turn on you or publishers turn on you. I have a really dark outlook when it comes to stuff like that, because I've seen it in action, the ups and the downs of a publishing career.
Well, and we've seen such sea changes in the types of stories that readers like, what's in vogue at the moment.
And, yeah, I know.
The good news is stuff comes back around almost always, though, if you've got a long enough outlook.
Yes, and all, you know, you got to take some luck to be able to be around for the next turn. Yeah.
Well, I interviewed an amazing writer the other afternoon named Eugenia West. She's 96 years old.
Wow.
And, yeah, and she's been writing and publishing, you know, for more than six decades. And I asked her, you know, the secret to your longevity, and what have you learned, you know, as a writer throughout that time? And her answer was that it's 10% talent and 90% applying the seat of your pants to the seat of the chair.
Right.
And it's, you know, she said it would be so trite to, you know, tell you this or that about, you know, sentence structure, mechanics, or outlining or whatever. You just got to sit down and do it. And
yeah.
Everybody comes to it differently. And it sounds like that you learned that same thing from your dad, just watching someone never giving up and doing the work until the work resonated with someone.
Yeah.
So what was it that drew you to law?
I think it was the same. That's a really good question. I think there's a sense of justice in it that, I mean, we're seeing it in times right now, right, where people kind of cling to the law as the thing that will save us all, you know, if we all just follow the rules and, you know, justice and all of that. I went to, I think like a lot of people who go to law school, I went really unfocused. I went straight from college, and I wasn't entirely sure where that general interest in law would take me. But I kind of thought that maybe I would do civil rights law, or maybe I always loved movies. So I was like, maybe I'll do entertainment law. And then when I got there, lo and behold, I was really interested in criminal law. So like all the things that drew me to mysteries and crime fiction, I found myself really liking the criminal stuff the best. And so I wound up becoming a prosecutor, and I still teach criminal law.
Nice. What
all was crime it? All the time, as I say. Okay. It's like an obsession with crime.
Did when you got into practicing law, did it meet your expectations? You know, movie law is nothing like practicing real law.
Right.
But when you're doing the kind of work that you were doing, was there enough of feeling that you were doing something that offset all of the downtime and the research and all of, you know, that part of being an attorney that no one likes?
Yeah, movie law is kind of like the 120 most exciting minutes you've ever had in your career. all in like one time. You know, there's a lot of it that is frustrating. You do, your hands are tied so often. You know, and the system is much bigger than any one person who's part of it. But I felt like, particularly as a prosecutor, you have, I think you can make a lot of difference in your own individual cases in terms of being thoughtful and trying to do the right thing and, you know, looking at the bigger picture and remembering, you know, being empathetic. You know, so I think I made a difference in my own cases. And then I did domestic violence prosecutions for a couple of years, so that's a different kind of work in a way. And then I also worked as a liaison to the police department. So, you know, I didn't know at the time I was going to wind up, you know, writing fiction for all of these many, many years. But I learned so much about kind of behind the scenes of how police departments work, how the institutions work, how people talk to each other. So I draw on that all the time. So I'm really glad I did it. Yeah. It affects my writing. It affects how I teach my students. So it was 5 years well spent.
Yeah. Well, and your students benefit not only from your time practicing, but the fact that you also write fiction. Do you feel like that the fact that you're a fiction writer and a practicing attorney affects the way you teach?
Well, I think I like stories. So instead of,
yeah.
I don't,
that's what I was hoping you would say.
I think I can explain to them sort of why the doctrine matters, I think, sometimes to just kind of make it a little more accessible. And I think you also learn that when you try cases, you're basically teaching juries law in a way, but you have to do it in a way that is accessible and intuitive and they can understand it. So hopefully, mostly my students do not care that I write books. They care what's on the final. They care what job's going to be waiting for them when they graduate. They care about their grades. A few of them will sheepishly come in around holiday time and ask me if I can sign books for their parents, and they look terribly embarrassed by their parents.
That's amazing. What brought you back around to wanting to write fiction?
I got an idea. You know, even though I wasn't thinking I would be a writer, I was always an avid reader. So, and I was still reading tons of crime fiction. And one thing I noticed is whenever they would get to, with the exception of Linda Fairstein's books, where you've got a prosecutor in the lead role, but at the time, every time you would see a prosecutor show up on the page, it would just grind to a halt, you know, that like they were never interesting characters. They never had anything interesting to say. They would be like, you need a warrant, hearsay, objection. And then they, you know, you'd skip 7 boring pages and go on your way. And meanwhile, like I was doing that job. I'm like, oh no, this job is so much more interesting than that. And so I got an idea about a prosecutor in Portland in the office where I worked, and I thought, you know, someday I'll write that book. And when I left, it was when I left the DA's office, and I think I missed it. I kind of missed Portland. I missed the office. I missed my friends. And so I was like, oh, you know, I always wanted to write that book. And I'd stay up late by myself and work on it. And if, for me, it was, you know, kind of like being home in a weird little way. And it took me a few years, but I did finally finish it. I thought I'd write one book. I thought Professor Burke would have one novel on her in her office to say that she wrote a book.
Did as the idea comes to you, do you still work through new novel ideas the way you did then? A lot of times, a novel will begin either with a character or maybe a premise, maybe a headline that just grabs you, and then you start, you know, going through the what ifs. How does a story usually hatch for you?
The hardest part for me, frankly, is deciding like when I'm ready to start writing and what the book is about. because if you think about it, you can have lots of ideas, but the difference between a vague idea and what it takes to write an entire book is huge. And so at some point you have to pick one of those ideas and run with it. That's actually where I wind up spinning my wheels a lot. It's kind of deciding where to jump in. But once I do it, I kind of have to have that pull. It's almost like what you described. There has to be a premise or a scene, or usually it's a character in a situation. Like if I know who the character is, like I have a very good sense of that, and I know the dilemma that they're in, I can kind of flounder my way through a book until I have a first draft, and then I go through and change it a lot. But I kind of find the story through the characters as I get to know them. And so I write very slowly at first because I'm still kind of getting to know who these people are and what's making them tick and what's going to, you know, how they talk to each other. Like I'm finding the voices and all of it. And then by the end, I know them so well, it's almost like they're leading the way. And I'm like, okay, yeah, this is what would happen. And, you know, I can write the second half of a book in, you know, in an eighth of the time it takes me to write the first half of the book.
Wow. So you are, what is your pre-planning style? Do you outline, do you discover it as you go? I think that first half of the book is kind of your discovery process. Is that
yeah.
how you describe it?
Yeah. I usually, you know, at this point, I know the end generally. Usually I do, you know, I know who did what and why. And then I kind of find out, you know, okay, so what does that look like a month before that? And what does it look like 2 weeks before that? And I usually kind of know a few of the really big aha moments, the big turns. I know the basic cast of characters, and then I sort of just find my way. I make a lot of changes. The changes between first draft and final are pretty big.
Yeah. What was that first book that launched your publishing career?
It's called Judgment Calls, and it is about a prosecutor in Portland called Samantha Kincaid, and that was an envisioned series. There's three books in that series, and Samantha was, she's part of a, like, the drug and vice unit, so she's not one of the big, you know, homicide, major crimes prosecutors, but through the vice connection, a teenage prostitute gets attacked and left for dead, and she convinces the bosses to let her keep that case, and so she winds up finding these connections to a serial killer, and the case winds up a little bigger than she thought, but I really like that series. I like the character who's, you know, she's kind of like I was in the office, you know, the younger woman in the office with, you know, who wants the big cases and is hitting her head up against the wall sometimes.
did writing fiction and coming up with stories like that help you to work out some frustrations with the law? Is that ever a motivation?
Oh, yeah. I never wouldn't have thought of it, but yeah, I guess so. I mean, usually you can, my guess is readers, if they read a few of my books, they can kind of tell something I was chewing on at the time, you know, so The Better Sister, for example, you know, you've got these sisters who are pulled into, maybe we'll get into it, I guess, but with Chloe Taylor's husband gets killed, and her husband is also her sister's ex-husband. So there's complicated family dynamics, and then the stepson, who's her sister's biological son, becomes a suspect. And, you know, they're trying, both of these women who we're estranged sisters, have to come together to try to help this teenager who becomes a suspect in his father's murder. So, but in that one, I think people will see that just the dynamics of when, you know, a family is already working through its own trauma and working through the impact of a murder on their family, and then to layer on the criminal justice system on top of it, and how its edges can be so rough, and, you know, there's no nuance to it, and they don't feel like they're being seen as real people. And, you know, I think that there are kind of frustrations with the criminal justice system in that book. And then the book before that, the wife, it's a woman whose husband is accused of sexual assault. And a lot of my thoughts about, you know, the difficulties figuring out the edges to those sexual assault allegations through the legal process, like, is totally infused in that book. So it finds its way onto the page.
Yeah. Well, that's a theme that I've noticed in a lot of your stories, is that these preconceived notions and these the willingness of people to jump to conclusions and you know, immediately make their mind up about what happened. And
yeah,
a lot of times your stories, as in real life, are way more complicated than that.
Yes. you know, I think it adds to the, because, you know, I don't pontificate about the law for the sake of doing it. Luckily, I have a whole nother job where I get paid to do that. In the books, you know, I really only draw upon that stuff if it's adding to the plot or adding to character or adding to setting. And but I do find, you know, a lot of times, you know, because I know how the system works, I know how to use it fictionally to create tension and to add to the suspense and make the stakes higher. And yeah, so that stuff in the books.
Gotcha. You mentioned Linda Fairstein a little while ago. She was on the show a couple of weeks ago. Is there a fraternity of sorts amongst mystery thriller writers? Do you guys ever get together, compare notes, or you know, just talk about devious things amongst yourselves?
Yeah, I mean, I joke around that all crime writers know each other, but it really is true, and I'm sure you have found that. Like, I think it's because the circles we travel in are pretty small. You know, there's a handful of independent bookstores that we all go on book tour to. There's two main conferences. There's two big conferences, like BoucherCon and Thriller Fest, and then there's a few littler ones like Left Coast Crime and you know, some of the other regional conferences. But we meet each other at these conferences, and it tends to be pretty supportive group of people. Like, you hear about these feuds with literary writers, and there's very few of those in the crime fiction world. I think in part because we don't see each other as competing. There's so a lot of people who read the genre read a ton. So it's not like they're either going to read Linda or me, and so we have to war it out. It's they'll read both of us. So I think we share a lot of readers, and I think maybe because Linda and I both live in New York, you know, people come through here a lot to meet with their publishers and go to events, and so you have the advantage of... So I'm now really good friends with some of my favorite writers, people I read before I was writing. So that's really cool. And it's not like you sit around and talk the substance of your books, but, you know, it's nice to have friends who kind of understand the weird job that we have of, you know, frustrations of not knowing if you're going to have the next book deal, or the lack right now, you know, right when my book is out, like, there's literally nothing I can do. You know, the book is written, I can't change it, I can't affect how many copies are at the front of Barnes & Noble. You know, it's all in readers' hands to decide whether they like it, and that elusive buzz, you know, whether it's going to happen or not. So you try not to make yourself crazy, and your friends can be a good part of that, just to remind you, like, can't do anything about it.
Right. Hugh Howey said on the show a couple of years ago that that as writers, we don't compete with each other for the eyeballs of readers. Our real competition nowadays is YouTube and Facebook and you know, Amazon Prime and Netflix.
Yeah.
and all
the
of
news.
That.
The news.
Well, I've had
friends, you know, they're God forbid your book comes out the same day as the Mueller report, you know, it's like, guess what
right.
people are going to be reading?
Yeah.
You know? So I think that that's a perfect example of stuff you can't control. But, yeah, people are binge watching. They're finding their content. And, you know, people listen to books, right? So it's like, okay, fine, I don't care if you read my book or listen to it. I just want you to know the story. But people who like to listen to books now are listening to podcasts. You know, so it's, and that's free. And so it's, you know, the lines between the content are really starting to blur.
Yeah. But that's why we're here to steer people to books. It's a podcast to make you want to read. So hopefully we're doing a little bit to combat that.
I'm a huge podcast addict, but I also read a lot. So
exactly.
Yeah, I think people consume their content in lots of ways.
Well, I'll tell you what, if it weren't for audiobooks, I don't know how I could keep up with show prep. You know, we've done 600 shows in 5 years, and if it weren't for audiobooks, I couldn't do what I do. It's an amazing advance that I can put it on my phone and, you know, while I'm running errands or taking kids somewhere, I can be reading books. So
yeah, and there's a real talent to the narration. I've
seen absolutely.
Such a difference in terms of who the narrator is. It can make a huge difference in what the book feels like.
Right.
Totally.
Exactly. And sometimes I'll read a book and then go listen to the audio just because I want to hear someone perform it. You know, if I really love the story, I want to hear a little different take on it. So hopefully that's opening doors to readers that you know, want to binge content like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the new book, The Better Sister, I think I mentioned at the beginning of the show, closes out a trilogy of sorts that began with the wife and then the ex and now the better sister. Was that a conscious thing from the beginning that these books were going to kind of be thematically grouped together? Or is that something that just came in the writing?
It kind of just happened. So the first book was actually The Ex, and it's that's all right. A lawyer named Olivia Randall, a defense lawyer, represents her ex-fiance when he's accused in a mass shooting, and it digs up, you know, kind of old secrets of why they broke up and how it might be connected to what's going on now. And then the next book was The Wife, which I mentioned before. Angela Powell's husband is accused of sexual assault, and she has to decide whether she believes him, and then, of course, some surprising things happen because I tend to write books where surprising things happen. And then this one's about sisters, but I, when I was writing The Wife and the Jason Powell, the husband who gets accused of sexual assault, needs a defense attorney, I was kind of like, okay, these are, you know, he's a wealthy person. He's a high profile person. What kind of defense attorney would he call? And I thought of Olivia Randall from The Ex, and I'm like, he would call Olivia Randall. And then Olivia Randall's the defense attorney in The Better Sister as well. So she's the character who, it's not a series at all. I mean, she's a minor character in the book two and book three, but she's there to connect the dots for readers that these books are connected thematically. And I almost can't explain how they're connected thematically without giving spoilers away. But I think all of the books touch on family secrets and the way you can't leave the past behind, and you can't leave family behind as much as you try to redefine yourself. Your family defines you. But specifically, they touch on the role that women play simply by virtue of their family status, that, you know, Angela Powell is a different person as a wife than she is as a woman when you take away her marital status. And Chloe and Nikki are very the sisters in The Better Sister. Each of them individually looks so different than when you put them together. The minute you put them together, they're compared against one another. They fall back into their old family roles, that Chloe was the good one and Nikki was the funny but, you know, kind of troubled one. And even though they're now 40 years old and have been estranged for over a decade, they can't help but fall back into those old roles. And there's some themes that I think book clubs might find it interesting to read the books together or to talk about, but they're each standalone novels, so.
Right, right. And it's one of those things that if you've read all three, you see the connections. But if you don't read all three, you're not missing anything either. It's just little,
right,
little nuanced things.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's like little rewards for people who do read all three are in there. But you wouldn't read one of them, and they're not connected in any way. Literally, they're not serially connected.
Yeah. Right, right. So the Better Sister, as you said, touches on this sibling dynamic. And not only that, but you've got marital dynamics and children and stepchildren and these real layers of family complications. The sibling relationship is one of the weirdest relationships on earth. You've got this person that you usually spend
stuck with them. You're stuck with them.
And you spend like 20 years with them almost. I have one sibling. I have a sister that's a year and a half older than me. And a lot of times we were the only two people around. We were the closest two people on earth. But then you each diverge and go in different directions, and we don't live in the same city and all of this stuff. And you have this weird, super close connection that used to be. And it's, what a great dynamic to play off. When you started writing it, was that sibling dynamic the original thought, or did that come into the story?
At that point, I knew. You know, I knew the connections between the ex and the wife, and I knew I was still interested in this theme of the responsibilities that we all pick up, but women in particular tend to pick up when it comes to their family relationships. And I was like, okay, I want siblings next. And I have three siblings. I have two sisters and a brother, and I'm the youngest. And that seemed like too many siblings for a book. It's very complicated. If it were a TV show, I would love to have like a big cast of siblings. But I figured two sisters will get at the heart of, that fine line between sibling loyalty and rivalry and resentment, and how it can seep over from one to the other fairly quickly. Think about how weird that is. Parents, the way parents talk about their kids, if they have more than one of them, is really kind of ridiculous. Like, they stereotype them really early on. You hear people say about babies, like, oh, he's the good one,
Right.
Because he sleeps and eats, like, you get credit for being the good one. Or he's our little rule breaker, or he's our little rebel, And so they kind of label these kids with traits as if they're permanent and not situational, and always in comparison to each other. It's kind of remarkable that siblings don't all hate each other the way they're kind of pitted against each other sometimes. And it's interesting what you said, that you kind of go in and out of each other's lives. My sister, Andre, who I'm close to all my siblings, but, Andre and I take trips together and talk to each other pretty frequently. And she told me we were in Hawaii. We flew thousands of miles just to spend a few days together with my mother in Hawaii. And, she was kind of being wistful, and she said, I remember that fight we had, and because she was mad at me that I didn't come visit Wichita, Kansas very often, which I still don't because I grew up there and I don't go back to where I grew up, I guess. But, and I said something to her that, and I feel terrible, I don't even remember it. I said something like, we just don't have that much in common anymore. And she said it just broke her heart, because, like, to her, why should that matter? Something so superficial, whether you have things in common or not. She was kind of like, shouldn't have to have things in common with you. You're my sister, and that should be enough. It's interesting that you talk about that. Like, you can go for a while where you don't feel close, and then something happens, and you're close again. And so, you can't. These siblings are forever. The wedding vows say for better or worse, but really, siblings, the minute you're born together. I mean, that's unconditional love.
You're the only people on the planet that share the same DNA. It's
right.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
But what you were talking about a minute ago about how parents label kids, early on, and that really gets to the heart of that whole nature versus nurture debate. And, when your book really starts really digging into that, are these things, these dynamics set up from the beginning, or is it because we start doing this to people? That's a really fun thing to, you get in some really interesting mind games you can play with a topic like that.
Yeah. And Chloe's the little sister, but it's pretty clear that she's always been the more responsible one. She's the good student. She's the one who kind of became the boss of the family as she got older. And you know, it's just little things. Like one of the things that I know these are fictional people. I can't go back in time and be mad at Chloe's and Nikki's fictional parents. Like one of Nikki's memories of, you know, when she started to resent her little sister for being so perfect is she's forced to switch bedrooms with her little sister and give her the bigger bedroom because it's big enough for Chloe to have a desk in it, and her parents tell her that, like, unlike you, Chloe will use her desk.
Oh, my goodness.
like the idea of being ejected from your bedroom, you know, as a teenager to give your room up to your little junior high school rugrat of a sister. Like, I could see where that would lead to some resentment.
Yeah, I think so. You talked earlier about that first book that you wrote. You worked on it for a few years and got it the way you wanted it, sold it, eventually published. After that, we talk a lot about the gift of anonymity that comes when you're working on that first book and no one knows to expect anything from you, and you're just living in the world of your story, and you've got all the time in the world. And then you sell
it's
that book.
Thing.
It is. And then it all changes because then people know you're amazing and then they want more amazing from you.
Yes, your fun little passion project hobby just became a job. Congratulations.
Yes. How do you deal with that going forward, knowing that this thing that you just loved and wanted to do, and you still love, obviously, but it does morph into something that you're responsible for now?
Yeah, in an odd way, I've always kind of been envious of people who take a long time to get published, because I've had friends who are so dedicated to it that even though their first book hadn't gotten a publisher yet, they go ahead and start the second. So I've had friends that by the time they sell their first book, they're already done with their second or close to done with their second. And I didn't have that kind of faith in myself. You know, I wrote the first book, got it done, and then did nothing while I waited to see if it would get published. And then, you know, lo and behold, people wanted it, but wanted a second book too, and wanted it on a deadline. And writing for the first time under a deadline you figure out whether you're able to do it or not, let's say. My second book turned out fine, but you know, I think that entire year is a blur because I had just never done it that quickly before. And I know I changed who did it. I think my editor was driving her crazy up until the last minute, but it did happen. And then, of course, as you keep doing it, you know, it gets slightly less crazy every time. But a book a year is, it's, I mean, there are harder things in life to do, I'm sure, but it requires what we were talking about before, you know, putting your butt in the chair and just doing it.
Is there anything that has helped you through the years in dealing with that uncertainty of the story and second guessing yourself? Like you're talking about, you know, changing up until the very end. Does that get easier as you go?
Yeah, I think one thing that helps me now is I realize how I like the editing process. I like going in and changing things. Some writers don't. Like, they get attached to the first draft and don't, you know, it pains them to make changes. I really love it. And now that I realize that, it's somewhat freeing that the first draft just has to be built. Like, the bones have to be there, the characters and the story points have to be there. And then it's amazing what, you know, at least the work that I can do in a matter of weeks on a book, you know, once all the pieces are there. It's a lot easier to change things than it is to write it from scratch. So I think with time, now that I realize the importance of the rewriting process, it makes it easier to write it the first time. Like, it doesn't have to be great. it can be great later. It just has to be. Like, you're at least getting the story down on the page.
Right. Well, speaking of writing process, you also co-author this amazing series with Mary Higgins Clark. How does bringing another writer in and sharing writing duty, how does that affect your writing process? And how did you get started working
with
her?
That's a very different process. I know, because I flounder around and find the plot through character over the course of a year. You can't do that when two people are working on it. So we now have a pretty good system down where we basically have a writer's room, the way, you know, TV writers sit in a room together and they come up with the arc for an entire series and then dole out who writes what from there. We basically do that. So we will meet and talk and talk and talk and talk, like, for hours and hours and hours without writing anything. And we come up with the characters, their motivations, their secrets. We come up with the general plot, like what the twists are. Then we turn that into a synopsis, and then we start writing. So it's definitely a much more it's a much more sane way to write a book. I've tried to do it by myself, but it turns out you can't really have a writing room with just one person in it. There's nowhere to bounce the ideas
right.
off of.
I was going to ask you if that if there was ever a temptation to bring that dynamic to yourself, but it just doesn't work if you don't have that other creative mind going back and forth.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think when it's just me, I have tried it. If it's just me, I feel like, okay, well, that's enough for the day. You know, if I hit the wall, I'm kind of like, I'm not sure if this person's going to be a good person or a bad person or what exactly is making them tick. I'll be like, well, I don't need to figure that out right now. I know enough to write these two scenes today, and, you know, that's a day's work. But because we can't do that, you know, between the two of us, we have to think it out ahead of time. If I hit the wall, I'm kind of like, I'm not really sure what this person's motivations is, then the other person can say, well, what if this? And then the other person will say, well, that doesn't quite work, but I can see the direction you're going. And she and I work very well in that way. Like, other people are often in the room to take notes, or our editor will be there as a sounding board. But I think at some point, like, you can tell, like, that they're like watching a tennis match. Like, the words are flying so fast that they're like, wait a second, what are you guys talking about? It's like, don't worry about it. We've got this.
I love it. How did you get connected with Mary?
She had written a book called I've Got You Under My Skin, where one kind of subplot in it was a TV show called Under Suspicion that reinvestigates cold cases. And I think she and her publisher saw the opportunity for a series based on that show's premise. And I think, you know, she didn't want to, she was in her 80s at the time, and it didn't make sense, like, she would just start a new series to the, meaning not, no standalone. So she was open to the idea of collaborating with someone else to do the series. And fast forward, I don't know how my name got on there, but I got a phone call, like, Mary loves your books, and would you be interested in speaking with her about working together? And it's like, that's not a lunch invitation you turned down. So, you know, we just had a long lunch and kind of talked about how the process might work and the characters, and we wrote a couple chapters to see if the tone seemed even and how we both felt about it. And then we said, okay, well, we'll try it once and see how it works. And then we did two more and two more, and we're going to do two more. So I guess we're on our sixth book.
Amazing.
Now. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, your new book is called The Better Sister. It's been out for a couple of days now. Alifair, if people are just learning about you and want to dig more into your back catalog and find out all of the stuff that you've been doing and look forward to news and all of that good stuff, is there a place where they can connect with you online to read all about that stuff?
Yeah, my website is alifairburke.com. I'm also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. So I love hearing
Excellent.
From readers.
I'll put links to all that in the show notes. Alifair, this has been so much fun talking. We're going to put a link to The Better Sister also and send everyone to get their copy. Thanks so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thanks for reading the book and for talking to me about it. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Seven men ran the farce. The seven witch hunters. The court of Oyer and Terminer. They tortured and lied and mutilated and murdered. They knew those women up in Salem Village were no witches. Their true target was the coven hidden in their own midst here in Salem Town. They meant to hang the innocent until the sisters surrendered. Did they surrender? Said Jason. No. Was that the wrong decision? To let innocent women die and save themselves? What do you think? Should the coven have fought openly? Created more hysteria by swooping in on broomsticks and casting spells over Salem? Should they have killed the judges? There are no right decisions. That is the horror of a witch hunt. Everything you do condemns you. Question the judge, thou art a defiant witch. Question his laws, you question the king, and thou art a treasonous witch. Question his superstitions, you question scripture, and thou art a blasphemous witch. Pity the condemned, you pity witches, and thy Christian mercy proves thy collusion with Satan. Witch hunters are not just bad lawyers practicing bad law. They are men who place the ends before the means. They choose their victim, a man, a woman, an entire race, and mark them for extinction. All evidence is damning evidence. All associations are damning associations. All infractions, and who among us is without sin, are unforgivable infractions. Their own failings and abuses of power are shrugged away as mere vigor in pursuit of the public good. A witch hunter will have you by whatever means necessary. If he cannot find evidence, he will create evidence. He will entrap you and question you and distort what you say. He will walk you through the night until your feet bleed, strip you and stripe you, dress you in your own filth until you forget you are human. He will torture your friends until they betray you. And if anyone dares to weep at your hanging, he will drag them to Gallows Hill in the back of the next ox cart. Any man can be a witch hunter. All it takes is hatred and arrogance and the preening self-regard that proclaims, my deeds are always good because they are my deeds. The seven judges of the Salem court were such men. But one witch stood up to them. She stood up to centuries of unchallenged, murderous dogma and pronounced the magic word, no. They burned her for it.